Romeo India Whiskey. Is he here? That was WS2N. Paul just signed in. He was our space person. We have a hair. He's on deck tonight. We're also going to have KC2WGB. John, who monitors the website for Echo Link, and therefore if you have trouble signing in because we don't leave the right amount of space, John knows about it. Stand by a minute. And this TechNet, you guys have heard it thousands of times. The main purpose is education. The curious people in ham radio gather on Monday night, and we teach each other radio techniques. A person signs into the technical net because he does have a question or a comment by giving this group of guys your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. Also along the way, from time to time, we hear from Hal, K6DPZ, who has a lot of radio experience, and he's a celebrity this week. He was on the news quite a bit on Friday night. Okay, anyone to check in because you do have a question or a comment, give me a call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
82HUC, Steve, and yes.
Steve,
Ed, yes.
Ed, please give me your call letters again. Steve, I got. And Ed, give me your call letters one more time.
KD2CTY, King David 2, Charlie Tango Yellow.
CTY, Ed, we got you. So we got Steve and Ed. Anyone else to check in because you do have a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now.
We do 2OSR.
That mysterious person probably was a guy named Bob. Never heard of him. Okay, Bob recognized. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
H-Y-Y, Joe. Yes.
And we got Joe. Anyone else? One last call. Anyone else to check in with the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Hey, it's your guy for a quick one.
Go ahead with your quick one, Eric. And sounds like you're making changes to the system.
Yeah, have you raised your UHF antenna at this point?
In other words, I know that there was a change in your system on your end such that my antenna was no longer getting to it correctly. No, I have not made a change. Has there been a change on your end?
Alright, well, I'm going to make a change on my end. It'll probably happen tomorrow. And, I'll have to give you some new information because it's going to move from where I should be able to make it.
Sounds good. And there's about a 50-50 chance that in the next week I'll be making an improvement in my system also. More antenna support structures, more altitude. So, looks like improvement is on the way. Thank you, Eric. Anything else, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW.
That'll do it for now. It sounds like you got enough people. I've got a whole bunch of subjects that I'm crazy. I want to get into the math some other day.
When you say the math, meaning the math of digital television broadcasts, is that the math you're referring to?
Negative. As you know, I've been working on a couple of different projects. This has to do with vectors and impedance and even some antenna questions, but another time.
Well, we're going to make time for you on that one, Eric. After we ask the briefer questions, I've also done some study this week, and you guys have heard me say for at least a year and a half that changing the length of the coax cable does not change the standing wave ratio if you've got a ballon up top. And I know that both Hal and I have had a significant disagreement on that. And various people have wondered who's right. Well, the answer is it depends. I discovered that if you have a mismatch on both ends, in other words, you've got a 450 ohm lateral line being fed by a 150 ohm ballon on the bottom end, and you've got a 1-to-1 ballon at the top end feeding a dipole. If you've got a mismatch on both ends, in that case, the length of the transmission line does make a significant difference. It's a little bit similar to what happens when you build a quarter-wave matching transformer. It does a beautiful job of matching two impedances, but you can't willy-nilly change the length of the quarter-wave matching transformer. You'll be changing the match if you do that. Okay, Steve's the first guy, and what's the latest with you, Steve? KD2HUC, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick. Good evening, everybody. Dick, I got a fast question for you tonight. It touches upon something we were discussing a couple of weeks ago when I had asked about, if you could put a ballon at the bottom of a mast. And you brought up that the cable, with it, you know, if the cable is run inside the mast, that it then becomes a triaxial arrangement, similar to the cables that have two shields around the transmission conductor. My question tonight is there any interaction if multiple cables share that mast? And this goes whether the ballon happens to be at the bottom or at the top. Is there any interaction between having the cables together inside of a metal conduit or a mast? Is there any issue with that, and how exactly would that work? That's the question. Back to you.
Yeah, there's sort of a yes and a no to that one, Steve. And as it depends. Here's what it depends on. If I've got a lack of a ballon at the top end of one of the antennas that needs a ballon, assume it was a dipole, and you feed it with no ballon, semiconductor goes to the right side of the dipole and shield goes to the left side of the dipole. Therefore, you've got RF energy flowing on the outside of that cable. And let's assume that a second cable also has RF flowing on the outside of the cable. And now you put those two cables together by taping them together, putting them into a conduit or whatever. Yes, they're going to talk to each other. It's not going to make the antennas fail. They'll still radiate, but there will be some interaction. But under normal circumstances, the whole idea of coax cable is a thoroughly shielded structure. You use it correctly with the right kind of a ballon on the top if it's required, such that there is no RF energy flowing on the outside of the cable. In that particular case, the cable doesn't know where it is. It doesn't know if it's inside of a conduit. It doesn't know if it's alongside of another cable. It doesn't know that you've wrapped a whole lot of turns in it to make a poor man's balance, so to speak. The signal flowing down the center of that cable doesn't know what's going on the outside because it's thoroughly shielded from that outside. So I guess the bottom line is if you're using your coax cables in the right way, let me drop them. They do not talk to each other. You can do anything you want with them, with one exception. Don't put nails through them or straight pins through them. And don't make bends so tight that the center conductor drifts off to one side. I mean, every cable's got a bend radius you're not supposed to exceed. But other than that, you can put as many cables as you want together, and some guys do that. Some guys have a real bundle of cables where the transmission lines, the control cables for the rotators, sometimes power supply cables for amplifiers and converters that are on the top of the tower, all of that gets bundled together. So if you know what you're doing, you can bundle the cables almost any way you want, Steve. Maybe that's close to what you were asking. KD2HUC, K2LIW in the TechNet.
That is exactly what I was asking. So I guess probably in practice, it would be due diligence to maybe throw a couple of ferrite beads around the cable just to make sure that the shield stays clean.
Putting ferrite beads around the cable is kind of a band-aid. Yes, when you really buy a balloning device, inside of that ballon is a whole bunch of these great big toroidal-shaped things acting as an RF choke. That's the way most of them are built. And for you to homebrew that, it's one way of doing it. A poor man's ballon, just a few turns of the coax cable taped together, is another way of doing it. But to solve the problem in the first place, where if the antenna is a balanced antenna and you've got unbalanced transmission line, coax cable is called unbalanced. I mean, from the outside world, all that signal should be between the center conductor and the inner surface of the outer conductor. And there shouldn't be any signal on the outside of that outer conductor. That's really an unbalanced cable, whereas twin lead is a so-called balanced cable. So if you're using your unbalanced cable correctly, you don't have to do that. If you want to do it as a belt and suspenders, of course, nothing bad happens. But in many cases, you shouldn't have to do that. If you are feeding a well-made ground plane antenna, for instance, which has it's a VHF ground plane, and it's got its three little radials coming out of the bottom of it, that acts as a very good shield, so to speak, so that very little RF energy flows on the outside. You don't have to put ferrite beads on an antenna like that when up in the air.
Oh, well.
How many antennas are going to go on that mast of yours, Steve? And are you worried at all about the wind loading that it's going to have? KD2HUC, K2RIW, and the TechNan?
Right now I'm looking at putting 3 or 4 antennas up there. And, it's not going to be that high. Like I said, it'll probably be around 40 feet. I'm in the process of fabricating it. I'm doing the steel work now. And, so I'm not really worried about, as far as wind load. The concrete is already done. The footing is done. So, I'm progressing it, but I do have to start laying out how I'm going to install the antennas on it, obviously, because once it's completed and I start mounting brackets and whatnot. So, and of course, cabling it becomes, questionable. So I just want to make sure I'm prepared, and any, means and methods that I have to employ, I want to have them, in the back of my mind as I go through fabrication. So, but that answered my question, and thank you very much. Back to you, KD2HUC.
Can I have a comment, which is more like a question, but...
Go ahead, Eric.
All right, because we're talking about this subject, there's something that came to mind. Now, for many years, I had my satellite antenna set up. One antenna is a cross-polarized 2-meter antenna, the other one is a cross-polarized UHF antenna. It could be left-hand circularly polarized or right-hand circularly polarized, whichever way you hook into the relays for the quarter wave difference between the two. And between the two antennas, which goes through the rotator, because you're also doing elevation besides that, but, let me let it drop for a second. Instead of using a piece of steel or aluminum to hook the two antennas up to the rotor, use a fiberglass rod. Now, everywhere that I've read, and actually in my experience, they tell you that you're not supposed to run the coax along that rod to where the rotor is and then down. They recommend that you take it from the end of the antenna and use a drip loop before you bring it in. What I'm asking is, why do they suggest that? I think I know, but I'd rather hear it from you in terms of the interaction between the two. By the way, both antennas have gamma matches on each leg of the antenna. As you know, that it's being cross-polarized, you have two gamma matches per antenna. So, why the recommendation? Why are they suggesting that when you do that, meaning you run the coax along the piece of pipe to where the rotor is and then pipe straight down, and supposedly you're getting a good termination into the gamma match. So, your thoughts? K2RIW, K2JANK.
A properly installed gamma match really is a kind of a balance. That is to say, the shield of the cable is probably going to the boom of the antenna, and the center conductor is going to the gamma match. The gamma match is feeding the dipole, and in the best of all worlds, that works out very well, and there's no RF energy flowing on the outside of the cable. And so the fact that you've got two of them in a cross-polarized, circular-polarized, capable set of Yagis, that doesn't really matter. The guys who want to be ultra-conservative will run all of the cables out of the back of those antennas, and you got this great big loop of cable, a drip loop as you called it, coming back down to eventually the equivalent of the mast or the rest of the tower. They do that because they're afraid that the cable coming down the middle of the Yagi, and it's a case of a cross-polarized Yagi, the vertically polarized portion of that now has this cold polarized piece of metal called coax cable in that field, and they're afraid that that's going to create a problem. If the coax cable comes very close to one of those vertical elements, the capacitance it adds will slightly detune that element by carefully mounting it halfway between two elements. Almost never does that happen. And if you want to be super accurate about it, you can find out that the extra capacitance you've added by the nearby metallic object, which is tuning your director a little bit lower in frequency, you can readjust the length of the director to compensate for that and come right back to full performance. And that difference in performance is probably 1 or 2 tenths of a dB. Let me drop this more. is people are not properly envisioning real effective capture area. You take, for instance, my 19 element RIW Yagi, RIW 19 element insulated Yagi. It has a capture area of 5.5 foot diameter circle, 25 square feet roughly. That metallic object you put nearby, even though it's co-polarized, and it looks to you like it's going to be a great big shield, and that disruptless signal something fierce, a 1.5 inch or 2 inch diameter piece of tool being held in the same polarization out in front of the antenna, 1 foot. I've done that experiment, and I can just barely, on a ratiometry antenna range, measure a slight difference in performance. I'm casting a shadow of a few square inches on this 25 square foot effective capture area. All good antennas have a hell of a lot more capture area than your ICs. A 2 meter Yagi, for instance, probably has a capture area of a 10 or a 12 foot diameter circle. And so the little bit of shadow you cast with the metal support structure for your bed spring that's holding up all the antennas or the coax cables, that's not a problem. For safety reasons, in order to have longevity, you don't want that cable, that great big trip loop hanging out the back, swinging in the breeze. It's going to be a failure mechanism at some later time, and it looks homely. If you know what you're doing, you can always run the cable down the middle of the antenna, down the mast. And by the way, using a fiberglass mast, in my opinion, is a bit of a waste on the drop. It gives some people a peace of mind that they don't have a metallic object there. Well, that chunk of fiberglass, if it's heavy enough in wall thickness and large enough in diameter to be as strong as the aluminum mast would have been, or the steel mast would have been, it's still a very large dielectric chunk of material, which is almost by the same effect, detuning the antenna by nearby capacitive loading. So I'm not in favor of using fiberglass anywhere within an antenna like that for support. You get a lot more strength for weight ratio out of aluminum. And you can live with the aluminum being there even though it's co-polarized to the vertical portion of that Yagi, that cross-polarized Yagi. If you spot them, you can make that work out very well. I've sent letters to ARRL on this exact subject. It's a tough sell. Not very many people can envision the effective capture area. That effective capture area function is the main reason why you can stack Yagi antennas, for instance, extremely close together, even on the same boom, as long as they're on a different frequency, because that capture area only exists on that frequency. When I'm transmitting into my 6 meter Yagi, the 2 meter Yagi that's a foot above it doesn't exist, and vice versa. The effective capture area of each one of those antennas only exists on its appropriate frequency. KE2EJ, KE2RIW, good question, Eric.
Hi, K2RIW, K2J.
I just want to give you a little sense of my experience because I played with this a whole lot. One thing that I did find between using an aluminum mast and the elevation located to hold the two antennas and the fiberglass, right? And I've tried different lengths and different spacing between them because electrically, the 2 meter antenna shouldn't see a darn thing from the UHF antenna, especially while the UHF antenna is transmitting and you're listening on the 2 meter antenna. One thing that I did find that happened when I used the metal mast is that the front end of the 2 meter receiver gets an awful lot of UHF energy and it starts to force it, it actually starts to force where that near that transistor is operating down a little bit. It's sort of like, you know, when you're transmitting to a satellite, suppose you're transmit just enough, especially if it's a linear transponder that you're going to, forget about it, man. You're just supposed to bring up enough power to hear your signal come back. And the difference in the ability to hear seems to be better with the fiberglass as opposed to the aluminum mass between them. Explain that. What's wrong? What's not happening correctly here? Because I can actually look at the AC voltage and see that when I start transmitting, it starts to rise, and it actually forces the gain and the receive up a little bit.
Are you talking about cross-coupling now between your transmitter on the uplink frequency and the receiver on the downlink frequency and desensitization because of cross-coupling? Or are you talking about what you believe to be a real difference in the gain of the antenna from the viewpoint of the satellite? Which Are those two, or maybe the...
They're cross-coupling what's going on here.
Okay, so you're talking about cross-coupling, I think. In other words, the transmission on the uplink was desensing the downlink, and depending on whether you use an aluminum mast or a fiberglass mast, you sense a different amount of desensitization. Is that what you're saying, Eric?
Precisely. And it seems to be, it's not insignificant. It's significant enough when you're dealing with very weak signals coming back to you, because many of the linear transponders, their output is based upon your input, but the maximum output is pretty low.
If your receiver had a good enough bandpass filter that had enough rejection of the transmit frequency, and if the transmit frequency transmitter system didn't have any spurious harmonics,
you want to lose the almost 2 dB going through the bandpass filter. And even then, it's still, even with that in there, you know, even though as good as a skirt as it is, it still affects it.
Now, were you on a situation where the uplink was, say, 450 and the downlink was 2 meters, and therefore we're not worrying about the harmonics of the transmitter? Or, and are you fairly sure that if you looked with a good spectrum...
Analyze the size of harmonics are more than 60 dB down, actually, it's more like 75. They don't actually lie on top of each other. That's why they choose the frequencies they choose, so you don't get the second and third order between uplink and the downlink. Same thing going up to 2 gigahertz.
What was the uplink freak and what was the downlink freak, Eric?
Well, as you know, the satellite band is 145.8, and the uplink is 432, actually in this case it's 432.4 something.
Was there any possibility that the 432 transmitter had some spurious components that fell into the downlink frequency?
I looked. No.
And you had a, you didn't want to use the filter because it created 2 dB of insertion loss. And so,
A dB and a quarter, to be honest, you know.
Okay. And you couldn't afford to use the dB and a quarter? In other words, you felt you were too shy on the downlink?
Now, this was a dying satellite, so, you know, its output was low. Batteries are dead, particularly doing its work on the solar cell. So, the output varies, goes up and down. But, you know, I can't be absolutely positive that all conditions are exactly the same each time I tried it. So, it's really unfair. It's not a controlled test, but it's just an observation.
It's my belief that 90% of the time when desense occurs, it's occurring downrange in the receiver, second, third, fourth stage. As such, you could put that filter after your low noise amplifier. Now you're getting rid of the undesired frequencies, and hopefully your uplink frequency is not going to have such a response that it's overloading that low noise preamp. So if you had put that filter after the preamp, I think you could have had the best of both worlds. Eric, go ahead.
No, that's ultimately what I did. I put the filter ahead and cranked up the gain at the front end a little bit to compensate for the loss of that. I buy a little noise, which is, you know, in sideband it's variable, but in some other modes it, you know that it's there. But, you know, you're starting off with a gap set transistor. It's got a noise figure of like 0.06, 0.05, something like that. So, you know, I'm picking hairs here.
When you did put the preamplifier, when you did put the filter after the low noise amplifier, did you then get the best of both worlds where you didn't get descents and you're now filtering out the uplink frequencies, getting into the downlink? Go ahead.
Yeah, based upon the measurements that I made, I needed to increase my transmit power by about a quarter of a dB to compensate for the system, but I didn't have it in place.
But if your low noise amplifier has, let's say, 19, 20 dB of gain, and you're putting in a 1.5 dB insertion loss filter after it, I'd like to believe that now that system has full sensitivity, and now with the presence of the filter, you shouldn't be seeing any descents, whether you've got an aluminum mast or a fiberglass mast. So that is usually the best system. To overload that low noise preamplifier requires an amount of signal like probably 0 dBm. I'd like to believe your leakage coming through. Let me think about that. 0 dBm is a lot easier to... You're probably transmitting 10 watts on the uplink, therefore we're talking about 40 dB of loss here. You might not have had 40 dB of insertion, of isolation between the two. It's a little bit close, isn't it, Eric? Go ahead.
I understand, Dick. Actually, where this Memphis preamplifier actually was operating, and just at the point, the dynamic range of it is not that great, because it begins to operate just at the point of the conduction. Although the way that sensor is biased, it allows you to get signal through there until you hit something like, add enough dynamic range to take a signal that was maybe 300 or 400 microvolts before you started to see it flipping.
300 or 400 microvolts, that's a lot of signal. And by the way, when you do have a filter after the low noise amplifier, and if the amount of signal on the wrong frequency coming into the low noise amplifier is starting to...
IP3 right off the bat.
I missed that. Try that again.
You got all sorts of intermodulation products when you do that.
When you do that, what is the that?
Put the preamp there, looking at the entire wall without any kind of filtering.
Okay, so you do need some minor filtering in front of the preamp. The antenna itself is a bit of a filter, not a real good one. And so a low insertion loss, minor filter in front is certainly required. And then a good filter afterwards. Under those conditions, when you make a strong enough signal on the wrong frequency into that low noise amplifier so that it starts going into limiting, it doesn't necessarily make intermods. It just goes down. If you put it 1 dB into limiting, it has 1 dB less gain on your frequency. As long as there's a good filter after it and the rest of the receiver is working correctly, losing 1 dB of gain on your low noise amplifier, going from 19 to 18 dB of gain, that shouldn't hurt the overall sensitivity of the system if the rest of the system is well designed. There's always a conflict of interest of getting the maximum dynamic range, maximum sensitivity simultaneously. It takes a careful setup of the gains in the right places and the filters in the right places. And so I do believe you that with your particular arrangement, when you went from fiberglass to metal or metal to fiberglass, the amount of cross-coupling between the uplink and the downlink system did change. There's probably ways you could have choked some of that system. I bet you're a poor man's balance in the right place on the 450 line to make sure it's more isolated from the 2-meter line, so to speak. Maybe would have helped, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
That's an interesting thought. I never tried that, because I always considered it to be a pretty decent impedance on the antenna. The visual is always very low, especially the frequencies that I can send with. The antennas are not big stuff. It wasn't really any kind of a problem, it was just UHF that really was kind of annoying.
You got to be careful with getting a good visuar. A good visuar is a necessary but not sufficient. It really means the end of that cable is seeing a 50 ohm load. It doesn't tell you whether or not signal is flowing down the outside of that cable, and you've really got a common mode condition. There's a lot of things it doesn't tell you. It doesn't tell you whether or not the antenna is running at high efficiency as opposed to coupling a lot of signal into that volumetric material called earth, if it's a ground plane antenna mounted on the earth. So good visuar is a necessary but not sufficient. There are people who think once they get good visuar, everything is perfect. Not necessarily true. Okay, I'm going to move on to the next guy, which was Ed, KD2, Charlie Tango Yankee. Go right ahead, Ed, K2IW in the TechNet.
Hi, Dick. This is KD2 CCY. I have a question about a Garmin GPS, and I was just wondering how it calculates altitude. I called up Garmin, and they told me, I got two different answers. One was that there are topographic maps built into the unit, and the other answer was that there was an altimeter installed in the unit. And I think it does it by calculating a triangulation between the satellites. And I was just wondering if you knew the answer to that.
Hey, you called it triangulation, it's trilateration. In other words, what the GPS receiver does is it measures the pseudo range to each of four satellites. when you've got one satellite and you know the range to that one satellite, and you draw a sphere around that satellite, let's assume the satellite is 10,000 miles above you, and you draw a sphere with a radius of 10,000 miles, you're located somewhere on that sphere. When it picks up a second satellite, now the intersection between those two spheres of those two satellites is a great big circle. You pick up a third satellite, and now you know you're on one of two spots on that circle. You pick up a fourth satellite, you know exactly where you are. Once the system picks up four satellites, it knows where you are in three-dimensional space. It knows your latitude, your longitude, and your altitude. Now, because of the way the geometry of the system works, the altitude measurement is usually a little bit lower in accuracy, but it doesn't need other pieces of information to know your altitude. As long as it's got four birds, in theory, it knows your altitude with a little bit less resolution, a little bit less accuracy than it knows your latitude and longitude. So you start drawing four spheres that are mutually intersecting each other, and you look at the number of spots that meet all of those conditions. There's only one spot. You can get a pretty good piece of information with only three satellites, but you don't get altitude out of it with any great accuracy. It takes the fourth satellite. So I think there's a way you can ask Garmin, how many satellites is it seeing at this instant in time? If it sees four, it should know your altitude. Over to you, Ed, K2RIW. By the way, that's a nice set of call letters you got. You happen to live in New York City, and your call letters are CTY, city. I'll bet you did that intentionally. Over to you, Ed, K2RIW.
Actually, it was a random call letter from the FCC. But yeah, that answers my question. And because I do notice that the altitude is lower than what it should be. When I see, like, measurements, when, you know, when I'm driving down the road and it says that you're this high, it's always a little low, on the low side. So it probably is getting the, it probably is calculating the position from the satellites, and it probably is on the low side.
There's a great science experiment you can do, Ed. In other words, when you talk to Garmin, they said maybe it's using the lookup table, knowing that the land on your particular address is X number of feet above sea level, and assumes that you're a few feet above that land. You're in a place called New York City where you have the ability to get into a 20, 40, or 60 story building. So you could stand at street level, ask Garmin, what is my altitude, then go into that building at that location, and if Garmin gives you a new altitude for your new altitude placement, then you'll know that it really is looking at four satellites and not a lookup table for that particular address. So that would be a great experiment. I wonder what you'd find out if you did that in. KD2CTY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Actually, the unit knows when I'm upstairs or when I'm downstairs. If I'm in the parking lot, it tells me, you know, I'm pretty close to ground level. If I'm upstairs, it tells me I'm around 175 feet. So it is doing some kind of calculation there.
Fantastic. Eric, you wanted to add something to this?
Yeah, I've tried that experiment at Empire. Of course, I had the opportunity to go outside on the 81st, trying to hold something out the window. Interesting. But even in the city, generally the way the receivers are, they extrapolate from like 12 or 14 satellites, so it's hard to try and make your receiver just hang on to two or four.
Now, I wasn't saying that you should make it hang on to a lower number. All I'm saying is that you can get a pretty good location out of three satellites. The fourth satellite really makes it, what's the word for it now? There's no restrictions on it figuring out where you are. As it gets more satellites than four, if the system now has enough computing power, it can now look at all the combinations. If I know I'm going to get the full solution out of four satellites, and if the thing is now seeing eight satellites and it starts playing four of them at a time against each other and looking at all of those possible addresses and then do the mean value of all of those, so to speak, you can get increased accuracy. There's a mathematical name for that process, which I can't think of right now. So the more satellites, the better, as long as you have the right computing power on board. Do you believe your particular GPS, Eric, is not going to be overloaded by all of those extremely strong signals on that 86th floor? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, let's put it this
this way. I used to have a repeater up there. It was like, you know, even with three bandpass filters and cavities in front of it, it's a problem. But, interestingly enough, GPS is here. I had no problem whatsoever. Do you know if the military still wobbles it? Because I think they stopped doing that, did they?
Yeah, they absolutely did stop doing it, except they have the ability to do it during wartime, but they've stopped doing it. And by the way, if you watched 60 Minutes tonight, half hour of that program was on military satellites that are doing GPS and a whole lot of other functions. And right now our military is a little bit concerned about the other countries that have the ability to do satellite destruction. And there was an example of a satellite destruction that took place. In other words, an anti-satellite was used against another satellite. You would think that it would just simply knock out that satellite. Well, it made 26,000 pieces of junk in space. And when you see the map of that junk, oh boy. Was there somebody else that wanted to add to this? Please give me your call letters right now. K2RIW, the TechNet.
K2YO.
You're K2YO, and I think there was another person. Who was the other one? You've got it, Bernie.
Okay, so you're saying that the calculation is done based on the distance from each one of the satellites. I'm assuming that to calculate that distance, they're having to use time for that. How does the GPS get as accurate enough time to be able to measure those delays?
Yeah, lots of people will use the word triangulation. That's not it at all. It's trilateration. In other words, it knows what's called pseudo-range. In other words, it measures the apparent range to each of the four satellites it's considering at any one instant of time. And by that process and by another process, it manages to eventually increase the accuracy of its onboard clock, something fierce.
The older satellites have Iridium clocks and the ones have cesium clocks.
Yes, but that clock is in a bird 10,000 miles up. How does that information of that clock get to your particular local clock that's in your hand? The clock in your hand eventually has to get right on the right frequency. And what I think is happening is when you get enough of those satellites being received and you look at what's called pseudo-ranging, in other words, you look at the four apparent ranges to each of those four satellites, and you'll eventually come to the conclusion that, hey, my local clock must be fast or slow because all those numbers don't come out right unless my clock is on this particular time. In other words, in order for those four ranges to come out to a real place near the surface of the Earth, your local clock has to be pretty darn accurate to the nearest, I think, a couple of nanoseconds. Anybody got any further comments on this? K2RIW and the TechNet.
A follow-up question?
And by the way, the word I was looking for is the overdetermined solution. If you've got enough computing power in your particular brand of your GPS receiver, and if it's receiving more than four satellites, and it's now playing various combinations of those satellites four at a time against each other, I think it's called the overdetermined solution. And as it gets more and more satellites and uses the right horsepower, you can get higher and higher accuracy out of that before you start using the other augmentation techniques. Go ahead, Bernie. K2RIW in the TechNet.
The signal put out by the satellites, does that include a clock signal? Or just, you know, sorry, that was a bad choice of words. Does that include a real-time value?
Comes out interesting.
Well, say that again, Eric, and say it slowly.
The time code that comes down with the GPS is called Idris. I forget what it stands for. But, for example, at the stations, I have an Idris to SMPTE time code converter. It's a different format of time code. It's embedded in the string.
Yeah, the satellite itself, Eric, is Barry, is turning out, is transmitting a pseudo-random code. That pseudo-random code only locks up when you're correctly, when your local clock is near the right number. So your local clock starts off with an approximate number that during the process of receiving more than four satellites, that number gets refined. If your local clock was slow, I think that it would indicate is that the four pseudo-ranges between you and those satellites would be a number number that's impossible. The satellites are not that far away, if you know what I mean. So the system eventually figures out by more than one technique what your local clock has to be in order to get a realistic solution. That's my basic understanding, and I don't have a... I was closer to it at one time. Over to you, Bernie, K2RAW.
Yeah, I would assume that the, let's call it the rough time that comes straight down from the bird, you start with that, your GPS is locked onto four different satellites, so then it starts calculating your location based on now, a second from now, 2 seconds from now, backwards, you know, basically scan a range of these, and calculating which ones would put you anywhere possibly on the, you know, on the surface of the Earth. That I could easily see the answer being way off in space or down, you know, way down below the surface. And so that may be one of the techniques they use to start getting the clock more and more accurate. And then, yeah, once you've got a whole bunch of birds, the accuracy goes way up. Part of my the second follow-on question was, you said the altitude is not as accurate as the Latin lawn location. And you're saying it's not as accurate. Are you measuring that in inches, feet, yards, miles, etc.? What kind of range are you measuring that less than accurate in?
Because the birds that you're seeing are usually close to straight overhead when you're in a metro area, you now have pseudo ranges to those birds which are very narrow in angle from your point of view. Yes, if you're standing out in the middle of the Mojave Desert and now you're looking at all the birds horizon to horizon, in that situation I think the elevation accuracy can be a hell of a lot higher. But under normal circumstances, I think the elevation accuracy by calculation is a little bit lower because of the angles involved from your point of view where you stand in the Marble Canyon of New York City. There's another point I was going to make about this one. I've forgotten it. And by the way, I'm using the same numbers. In other words, if your particular GPS, without using any of the augmentation systems, can locate you to the nearest plus or minus 40 feet on the planet Earth, your altitude, in some cases, could be more than 40 feet wrong, is what I'm saying, using the same units. May not be always true. I'm not sure if you did a whole lot of measurements of your positional accuracy and your altitude accuracy. I'd love to know how those numbers turn out. From your experience, Bernie, you knew where you were. Your GPS said, I think you're here. You've got a vague idea of how much positional accuracy in Latin long, how positional error it had in Latin long. And if it did predict your altitude, did the altitude number in feet turn out to be higher or lower than the error in Latin long? K2IO, K2RIW in the tech net.
K2IO, I can tell you from geocaching that my handheld GPS is about as accurate down to 10 feet. And I know that because I'm standing someplace, I'm looking for a highly accurate Latin lawn, and as I stand there, I can watch myself moving in space, that I just moved 2 feet that way, and then 3 feet that way, etc. And so I'm assuming that's the error that I'm seeing, but those numbers usually are within about a 10-foot range. I do not have any data on checking altitude. I've used my GPS altitude just to say, hey, wow, we were there at 200 feet, now we're 250 feet. You know, just those kind of things.
Yeah, when you see the wandering of your apparent place, location of 10 feet, 10 feet to the left and 10 feet to the right and so on, you're looking at the dithering, so to speak, of your apparent location. That doesn't necessarily indicate your accuracy. In other words, it may be changing your apparent location 10 feet left and right, 10 feet forward and back, but the overall accuracy might have been 50 feet wrong from that point, if you know what I mean. So unless you knew the exact location, in other words, if you were looking at a map and it predicted that you're at the intersection of Smith and John Street, and in reality you were three blocks away, then you would know what the real accuracy was. So I wonder if you were using it in that manner, Bernie. Over to you, Bernie, K2RAW.
Are you familiar with something called geocaching?
Give us a few words on geocaching. Go ahead, Bernie.
Geocaching is basically there's a website called geocaching.com. You go there and you find somebody will hide an object and then give you a Latin wand to go find it. When you find it, it's usually a Tupperware container or an ammo can with just little, you know, children's toys, chopsticks kind of stuff in it. But the challenge is to go find them. Or maybe it's a place that you go there and you have to answer a question about what you saw. And so the people that are posting these are posting you a Latin wand. If I remember correctly, they're going 4 digits to the right of the decimal point. So they're just doing, say, last dot, and then 4 digits. And so you're following those coordinates. Those give you the coordinates of where you need to go. When you get there based on your GPS, I can get there based on the GPS, but then I notice if I stand there for a moment, it'll move me around, and that's where I'm saying that I'm seeing it.
However, it allowed you to find the geocached object, but what was the absolute accuracy? Did you have any way of checking absolute accuracy? The reason why I used a Smith and John Street, so to speak, in other words, in theory, there's an exact latitude and longitude of the intersection of two streets in a known city. And so, you didn't predict that you were a block away. Over to you, Bernie.
Correct. We're posting the information. I heard their data was. Brings up an interesting point, and when I get a chance, a few years ago, I had my boundaries marked on my property. I was able to call the surveyor that surveyed it in 1956, who was still alive. He must be in his 90s now. He sent one of his crews out. They started across, I live on a corner, and they started on the corner diagonally across from me and started shooting vectors towards my house. And I went over and talked to the nice young man, and I asked him, why are you starting here? And he pointed to, on the sidewalk, somebody had taken an angle grinder and had cut across this whole thing 2 inches by 2 inches. And that cross was hyper-accurately measured. They measured my property based on that. I asked him for an accuracy number, and the guy looked at me like I had really questioned his wife's fidelity. He was offended when I asked him about it. Upset, but it just puzzled him. Why would I ask? And he finally ground out a number. He said he was accurate within a couple of millimeters of location on Earth. So he's saying that X is accurate to a couple of millimeters. I will call them and ask and find out what the location of that X is.
Yeah, that X could have been a local, local datum point.
Called a benchmark, Dick.
Okay, benchmark is the right word. Okay, so that local benchmark, the whole darn United States is based on a place in Kansas, I think it was, the geometric center of the United States. There's a particular ranch in Kansas where everything is based on that, or at least it was in the old days. Fun stuff. And so, in theory, you can get down to feet, inches, and maybe even sub-inches of accuracy with some of these augmented systems with the GPS-like major determining equipment. And as such, in theory, you can have a different latitude and longitude for each one of the corners of your desk at your place of work. However, along these lines, there was a couple of articles in the last month about these super-accuracy clocks they're coming up with, which are considerably better than rubidium and cesium, where the super-accurate clocks are now using Einstein's relativity. As you start raising a clock a few feet further in altitude above the Earth, it's now experiencing a very slightly different amount of gravity. That slight difference in gravity makes the clock run a little bit slower from your point of view. When you've got one clock on the desk and the other one you're raising up on the shelf, so to speak, one clock runs faster than the other, and because they're now so accurate, you can measure feet of difference in altitude as a change in the clock rate at which it runs. There's been experiments in the past where people have flown airplanes with accurate clocks in them and go around the Earth, or they put accurate clocks on satellites. Each of the clocks that are on board the geo-positioning satellites have to be offset.
Repeater, timeout.
As I was starting to say, each of the clocks... clocks on the geopositioning satellites had to intentionally be programmed with an error, knowing that the measurement of people on the ground are going to see this difference because of these relativistic effects. Crazy stuff. Okay, we're going to go on to Bob. W2OSR. We'll discuss anything except antennas. What would you like to talk about tonight, Bob? I'm having some fun with it. W2OSR, K2RIW in the Tech Net.
TSN calling.
Air deck W2OSR.
There's a very weak signal trying to sign in. We just barely hear you. But we're going to go to Bob first, and then I'll pick up that person. W2OSR. Go ahead, Bob. K2RIW in the Tech Net.
Not sure who that is, Dick. I can't hear him from where I am. At any rate, mine is just a simple request. I'm getting into the digital world here with the DMR, and I've got the radio. Built a programming cable today, and now I'm at the point where I need the right numbers and information to enter into the program so I can program the radio. So if somebody's got that and send it to me, it would be greatly appreciated. My call sign at the league will work, W2OSR at ARRL.net.
Give the model number of the radio you need to plug for.
Yeah, I think W2PPN is the local expert, I believe. But Bernie, I'll go right ahead with your info. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW in the Tech Net.
No, I was saying, Bob, tell them what model number radio you have, because it differs for each one. I can help you. You've got a Kinexis or a Motorola, but I can't help you with the TYT kind of radio you have.
Okay, yeah, I'm using the TYT MD380.
All right, now we have a Hightower on the website. Roger, Dodger. Tell Bob that I think it's wide. There's a couple of guys that are passing around the code plug. All you have to do is download it. About 10 minutes from now, I will dig it up and send it to them. Sounds like the data is on the way to you, Bob. And it sounds like Eric's got it. I'm also hearing lots of people talking to into Ben, and also, who's the other guy? It's not YHY. There's a couple of guys on this particular repeater, or on the 449 repeater, who have acquired a lot of knowledge in this, shipping information back and forth to people as to how to program these DMRs. W2SR for any other comments, K2RIW and TechNet.
Dick, just thank you to everybody, and I'll look for what Eric has sent to me. I'll say 7-3 to everybody for this evening. W2OSR.
Okay, bye-bye for now, Bob. Eric, I'm a little bit concerned that I'm not hearing the beeps of resetting. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
I listened to the input.
Okay. The next person on our list was Joe, W2RYY. W2RYY, KQRIW. Go ahead, Joe. And go easy with us tonight, Joe. You've asked some pretty tough questions in the past.
Can you hear me okay?
Hearing you loud and clear. Please proceed.
Okay. Well, here's a quickie question. How much does it cost to have a high-wing aircraft taken apart and reassembled in your driveway? Come up with an answer for that one first, and I'll ask you a real question.
Well, if I lived on 608 Yale Street in Oceanside, I've got all those friends that I've got that can help me move things with a flatbed trailer, I think I can probably get it done for a favor. Oh, you, Joe, here we go. Joe, you got it. K2RIW.
Really? That's an amazing feat. Okay. Here's a for real question for you. I've been monitoring frequencies in the mid 50 megahertz area. And the phenomena I see from time to time, listening on a known frequency from stations supposedly in a known direction, I see intensity of these signals appear out of the noise, come up over the noise, but sometimes a very short period of time, like 1, 2, or 3 seconds, I'll see a 20, 30 dB difference in signal coming out of the noise, comes up in level, then goes back down. Sometimes the signal stays up a lot higher than that. Usually, from what I remember listening to, like low band, you know, skip. Usually, stuff hangs in there for like quite a longer amount of time. But in the direction I'm listening to, I'm not listening to something over the land. I'm listening to something primarily over a probably totally a water path. Back to you.
I think there's a good chance, Eric. I mean, Joe, that you're listening to a meteor scatter. Meteor scatter trail quite often lasts for a few seconds, and then goes back down again. I will admit, though, that a meteor scatter reflection is usually a signal that's hundreds of miles away. You don't get a meteor scatter enhancement when you're listening to somebody 30 miles away and you have almost line of sight. So do you think meteor scatter could experience what you're describing? The meteor scatter has a characteristic to it where it abruptly starts. It's got a very sharp leading edge and a pretty slow trailing edge, if you know what I mean. And if you recognize that waveform, it might have given you a clue. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, the TechNet.
I don't know if I've really noticed that. It seemed like the signal comes on. I'm looking this on pretty much on a spectrum analyzer, not a receiver. And the signal I see comes up. It seems to just, you know, take a few seconds to come up out of nowhere, appear at a certain level, hold that level for a very short amount of time, 3, 4, 5, maybe 5 seconds, maybe only 1 or 2 seconds, then it seems to decay about the same way I sort of come up in amplitude going positive. It seems to do the same thing going back negative. So it does seem to correspond to what you're talking about exactly.
I think 90-some-odd percent of the time, Joe, a meteor scatter signal has this abrupt rise time, hangs in there for a while, slowly decays, and when it decays, it should thoroughly disappear, and it should be a signal that you were not hearing ahead of time. Most of the time, a meteor scatter signal is coming from hundreds, almost 1,000 miles away. Therefore, it's way beyond your radio line of sight, so to speak, and it's only the meteor trail that's giving you the method of getting the signal. So the way you were describing it earlier, it sounds like the signal was there weekly, and now it came up in magnitude. I'll admit that meteor doesn't fit that requirement where you were hearing it before. Now the next thing would be aircraft reflection. And so in the case of aircraft reflection, only a couple of seconds is hard to figure out the geometry of how an airplane would help you. When I was on 432 transmitting 480 miles to K4CAW in Greensboro, North Carolina, we would see aircraft reflections that were giving us a huge enhancement in signal, and they lasted for numbers like 30 seconds. But I guess the geometry of a 480-mile path and when the aircraft is in the right location, there's now a bigger volume of space that's in the right place, if you know what I mean. So a local aircraft, that's a slim possibility. Other than that, you've got a bit of a mystery there. You've been observing this effect for how long, Joe? W-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, the TechNet?
I've been observing it since about the beginning of July. And what made me start observing it was I had my, you know, analyzer hooked up to the outside antenna. I saw the signal. I wasn't looking specifically at this frequency, which happens to be 55.24. And I wasn't specifically looking at that frequency, but I was seeing nearby, and I saw this thing just come out, seemed to come up out of the noise, so I put the analyzer in narrow dispersion, and like 10 kilos per division, and it was sat on that frequency for a while. And I, you know, watched it, and swung the antenna around a different direction, and I finally left it one spot at about 170 degrees. I believe this is coming out of the Caribbean someplace. Probably something about 1,500 miles away, and I'm looking for a television signal, because one time it came up strong enough where it was about minus 50 dBm, and I was able to start slowly seeing an analog picture come into my television set. And then, but I haven't seen that. That only happened really once on one particular day, and I haven't seen it come up that high since. Back to you.
Yeah, 5524, channel 2. And I think that's one that's 10 kc low. I think right on would be 5525, if I've got it right. And so analog television channel 2 is kind of rare in the United States these days. So you think that was coming from the Caribbean, and also your direction